So last week, as we were looking at this line, let none deceive another or despise any being in any state, in our walk through the Metta Sutta here, this implication, any being in any state, opened into a little conversation, and then particularly in the question and answer period, around, and this always happens in the conversation around karma and conditioning, the idea that, here's a little really simple version of the teaching on karma and conditions, which is that everything that happens is based in or supported by a set of conditions. And it's a vast web of conditions. Some of those conditions are our own actions in the preceding moments and then preceding years and maybe lifetimes. Other conditions are the conditions of the various circles we find ourselves in, our family, our communities, our culture, the planet, all of the forces that affect us. And so then the choices that I make moment to moment are not free from the force of all those conditions. And that force is called karma. Karma, the word literally means action. The Pali version is kamma. Karma is the Sanskrit. It literally means action, and it refers to the lawful process of actions and their results. So if I do something, there's inevitably a result, and the tradition speaks of this in a really particular way. I own that result in a certain way, which is why in the Five Recollections it says, I am the owner of my actions, heir to my actions. In other words, what I do creates a kind of inheritance that's passed down in my family, and I am the heir to my own actions. If I do something unkind, I will experience the results of having done that. That's the law of karma. And so in some of the Asian traditions, this got interpreted, very literally, in a kind of if I steal in this lifetime, I'll be poor in the next lifetime. If I kill in this lifetime, I'll be murdered, violently in this lifetime or the next, things like that. But the texts themselves don't actually speak of it so literally. And the Buddha really talks about the results, the direct playing out of karma being the result of forces that are far too complex to really understand. Like, I do something, and that's going to have results that I will experience and others will experience. But how that happens is very, very complicated. I could say something mean to somebody, and that could have a terrible effect. Or I could say something mean to somebody, and someone else nearby could say, hey, that was mean. And I could be like, oh my God, that was, I'm so sorry. And we could all have a healing together, and it could have a very positive effect. Same action, but the conditions could be such that it could be shifted. And the tradition is very clear that the results are not predetermined. Right? If the results were predetermined, if it was always the case that a given action would receive or condition the same kind of result, the texts say liberation would be impossible, because then the force of past negative actions would be impossible to overcome. There's just too much of it. There would be always more bad results to deal with, and you'd never get free of that cycle. For us to get liberated from the cycle, and that's what liberation is talking about, liberation from this cycle of karma, depends on there being an out from the system. And that out is our own actions. And it's specifically the way that our actions, in this interesting paradoxical way, are conditioned by everything that came before and can't be said to be like the free will of a separate individual, because already all of this is held within the understanding that we can't see ourselves as separate either. We're embedded in community, embedded in the ecosystem. So then the Western mind, particularly steeped in ideologies of free will and the individual and individual salvation, often comes to this question and says, well, if everything is conditioned, how can I have free will in my actions? And if it's all, you know, if it's all conditioned, does that mean that it's all predetermined or something? But the texts are very clear in saying that it's not predetermined, that our actions are the one thing that has power to turn the force of the river toward good. And this is why the main thing that defines what an action is its wholesomeness or unwholesomeness. The Pali word is kusala or akusala. In other words, our actions either lean the whole ship, the whole momentum toward well-being, healing, kindness, generosity, taking care, or they lean the whole thing a little further toward disharmony, kind of harm, in various ways. And that's the only choice we have. But we have it all the time, every single moment. We have the possibility of making a conscious choice. This is why the aspect of karma that appears in us in our own kind of ongoing experience is often called, sometimes it's called karmic formations. Formations means like mental, emotional content. But it's also sometimes called volitional formations. Volition meaning this is the thing you actually can do. You actually have a hand in moment to moment. So that's the basic theory, is cause and effect churns on endlessly. And in the middle of this vast flow of conditions and their results, we have this little power to make a choice when we are mindful and awake to the possibility of our actions rather than being on autopilot and habit. We can make the choice to choose the wholesome, whatever that means, moment to moment. And that's that choosing the wholesome over the unwholesome is essentially a way of saying practice. So when I'm meditating, I can choose to come back to stillness rather than being lost in distraction. When I'm talking with somebody, I can choose to orient towards speaking kindly, to caring for others. And of course, having that choice depends on being awake in that moment, right? When I'm deluded or I'm lost in reactivity, I'm upset in some way, I lose my power of choice. That's the definition of being non-mindful, is that I don't have my power of choice in that moment. The mind is lost in story, or I've been swept away by a strong reactive emotion like anger or fear or desire. And the whole pull of practice is to wake up more and more, and within that woken up state, to make better and better choices. And if we make awesomely better choices, we can, in a sense, wake up further from the habits of greed and hatred and delusion. And so then they arise less and less. And there's a momentum toward them, in a certain way, not arising at all. And we just call that liberation. The texts just call that liberation. And liberation doesn't mean you've gone anywhere. Liberation is really just means you broke the addiction cycle, the addiction to being lost. So if that's the general model of conditioning and karma, then this line, let none deceive another or despise any being in any state, it's the in any state part that's kind of the rub, because it suggests, one way we can think about this is that it suggests that we could see everyone else, or just everyone, including ourselves, as being in a state. And that state is like, I'm in the state that's the result of all the conditions. And my state is maybe I'm upset or bored or like greedy or bitter or cruel or grateful or, you know, passionate or creative. We use kind of emotional terms to talk about state because it's kind of the totality of my experience in this moment. I feel inspired. I feel dragged down. I feel overwhelmed. Whatever it is. And so not to despise any being in any state. So I don't often despise the ones who are grateful, although I have been known to, but I try not to. But it's easy to despise the ones who are in a hateful state, right? Who are in a state that's causing them to do terrible harm. And this is where the question comes. Because it's one thing to say, okay, I'm going to practice universal loving kindness, and I'm going to try not to despise those beings, you know, who would, you know, shoot a bunch of people for seemingly for no good reason that I can tell, and really cause so much suffering, or who could, you know, enact policies that will harm so many, or whatever it is. Cut in line in front of me at the Bobo tea shop. How can some people be so cruel? It's easy to despise folks who are in a state like greed or hatred. But the teaching here is don't do that. In other words, you know, practice loving. Practice loving. And so I'm like, okay, I'm going to try to do that. And the question came in the comments yesterday, okay, but what about, and this is a very common question in relation to karma, what about holding people responsible for their actions? Right? Because if I recognize that person X is in a really terrible state, you know, their conditions have led them to be hateful, and that's a suffering. I can see, oh, this person must be suffering. No one would cause this much harm if they were happy and at peace. Then I can start to not despise them. But does that mean that I automatically, like, forgive and forget or just kind of give a pass on their terrible actions? And on one level, of course, the answer is no, right? Like, it's important if we take the whole system to mind to recognize that, yes, the conditions are tremendously strong and hard to resist, but every person does have this moment of choice, moment by moment, if they could wake up to that, to choose better. So on the one hand, yes, and this is the standard answer in Western Buddhism, that it's important to hold people accountable, that people are responsible for their actions. And I think this is a good answer, especially in an era where we're, as a community, certainly in parts of the Buddhist world that are embedded in progressive community, really trying to do better in relation to social justice issues and anti-oppression issues. So, you know, to actually say, oh, even though I intend otherwise, I'm embedded in privilege and racism, therefore racism comes out in my words and actions, even if I don't intend to. And I want to work very hard to uproot that habit, but it still happens. And so then it's part of, say, allyship practice to take responsibility for that, to be like, and that's my work. It is my responsibility. My actions are my responsibility. Or to say, you know, I'm not going to give a pass to someone who's, you know, anti-Semitic or hateful in this way or murderous. And I also think, as I was reflecting on it this week, and I was like, that's the answer I gave last week, and I stand by that answer. It's a good answer. But as I was reflecting on it this week, I was like, okay, so then can I find that answer in the texts? And I don't really, as I look at the early texts. When I see the Buddha talking about crime and criminals, which he doesn't do a lot, but there are some passages in the early texts talking about like what to do when there's a lot of harm being caused, say in a country. One of the texts, for instance, says, you know, a king notices that there's a lot of crime in the country, a lot of theft and violence. And in response to that theft and violence, he sends out the army and arrests people and throws them into prison. And based in that, families are disrupted and resentment is generated and nothing is done about poverty and violence increases and mistrust increases and nothing changes. But another king, seeing that violence and crime, theft have arisen in the country, finds the communities where crime is arising and offers food to those who are starving and gives seeds and tools to the farmers so that they can do their work and distributes capital to the business people so that they can open businesses and do trade and generally distributes the wealth, like makes it possible for people to undergo their living. And based in people having enough and their communities being sustained, poverty is lessened, greed and hatred are lessened, and crime decreases. So this is hyper-simplistic, and, you know, I don't know of anywhere that has an enlightened monarch that distributes resources widely like that, a nice socialist monarch. The last flare-up of this was in the late 60s. The Thai reformer Ajahn Buddhadasa published a book called Dhammic Socialism, Buddhist Socialism, really putting forward the case that the Buddhist teachings at their heart were socialistic. And it's on my dream list to write another version of Buddhist social, a book on Buddhist socialism now, so someday maybe. But anyway, that's the text. And it proposes then something really interesting in relation to, you know, big harm causing like crime, which is that it sees its conditioned nature. It says, oh, it arises out of poverty and oppression. If you can address the root causes and give people enough, that people actually just want to live ordinary lives, live their lives and run their businesses into it. You know. So even if that's a hyper simplistic kind of, you know, mythic or archetypal description of it, it still speaks to a different approach to, you know, personal responsibility. And so, you know, nowhere in there is punishment. And of course, here's a footnote to go look up the history of punishment and read Foucault and how the modern ideologies of punishing the individual for transgression come from very specific roots in the modern period. And many different cultures have ways of working with social transgression, essentially, that are very different from a discipline and punish framework. And so as I was thinking about it this week, I was wondering if I take the teachings on karma and conditionality faithfully or literally in a certain way, and then this teaching on, you know, getting at the root cause of violence and crime rather than focusing on the individual who caused it, then I start to reframe that answer that, like, you know, yes, as a wisdom practice, we work towards seeing everything as conditional, but we still want to hold individuals responsible for their actions. And I came in tonight wanting to just say that, like, I think that's a good answer for this culture because we are still so steeped in the ideology that the individual is the locus or the centerpiece of ethical action. But if we had a different viewpoint, that instead of individuals being the ones that choose to act well or badly, but that actually whole communities or whole cultures have a karmic momentum toward well-being or ill, we could shift our idea about what responsibility or culpability or you know, who's responsible for that action to be. I think it is important to say that there is responsibility for actions. But what if it's not necessarily the case that that responsibility is automatically individual? In other words, what if we actually take seriously the doctrine that separate individuals are not the necessarily the clearest way to understand what's happening when there's groups of people together. That actually whole communities or whole cultures generate action. And that to the extent that I have the capacity to do good, that's not actually because I as an individual have cultivated the karma to do good, but that the community or communities that I find myself into have the karma or the karmic momentum, have cultivated the possibility of doing good. Therefore, it's a privilege to be acting ethically rather than my own personal worth. And it's a wound to be acting unethically. And it's a wound that the entire community bears. We don't want to take the discipline and punish ideology and then just like in a too facile way transfer it from individuals to communities, though. That would be like, oh, well, that means that all, you know, all preppies who turn up their pastel-colored shirt and went to a prep school, you know, are evil because they are capitalism. But I wouldn't want to do that either. What I would want to do is say, oh, I want to love all the individuals, and I want to recognize that, say, an ideology that's held by a group of people can be a very strong momentum toward members of that class, whatever grouping it is, causing harm. And then can I respond in a systemic way to that karma? So, you know, we could take as an example the recent Me Too explosion. And I think here, like, we would perhaps want to say that there's a kind of both and thing that's necessary. Like, first, you know, let's throw Mr. Weinstein in jail. How about that? It's just as a start. But, and lots of people have commented on this very wisely, if we get lost in the individual sin, we lose the systemic orientation, right? If they threw Mr. Weinstein in jail and they were like, you've been a bad man, so here you go in jail. Lots of people would cheer. But some folks might then go back to sleep and think that like, oh, because they caught this one bad man, that the underlying system is now sort of restored to goodness. But of course, throwing Mr. Weinstein in jail will do nothing, really, for systemic oppression around misogyny and sexism, sexual harassment, etc. And so the socialistic approach, in a certain way, would be to say, do with Mr. Weinstein whatever feels most appropriate to make a dent in the systemic issue, but most of our attention should be on the systemic. And to recognize that there's a karma that has led to that harm being caused that's way bigger than that one person. And so, this is delicate, because it doesn't mean that he's off the hook for his actions. But it means that the thing that is really on the hook is bigger than him. And so, to recognize the conditioned nature of his actions is a way to say that, like, the path to liberation or the path to truly less harm being done must come from a much broader viewpoint than the individualistic viewpoint. It has to come from a systemic viewpoint. And broadly, this is the place where I'll say that the kind of systemic oppression theory lately really coincides with Buddhist liberation theory, especially around the emptiness of the sense of the separate individual. What if we let go, to some degree, of the illusion that separate, isolated individuals are doing what they're doing, whether for good or for ill? This means there's no more heroes either, right? That means like the singular person who swoops in and saves the day. It means there are no superheroes. We love them, It's so much easier to have Iron Man fly in and destroy something than it is to recognize that the roots of the problem can't be defeated by Iron Man, you know? Like the Marvel superheroes will never be able to fix climate change. All they can do is punch out bad guys. There's no bad guys to punch out with climate change. Although they could start with the Koch brothers, but it won't solve the problem, right? That's the whole point. So I think this is a beautiful, possible meeting point between the profound teaching of the emptiness of the self, the very immediately relevant teachings arising from the anti-oppression world, and then the subtle wisdom in the body of teachings around karma and conditionality. So here's the phrase again that we chant that reminds us that our actions are our own. And then, of course, it applies to everyone. I am the owner of my actions, heir to my actions, born of my actions, related to my actions, abide supported by my actions. Whatever action I do, for good or for ill, of that I will be the heir. What happens if we take that verse and we just say we instead of I? Mm-hmm. And to say that in some way this is the community or the whole culture or the planet of beings speaking. We are the owners of our actions. Heir to our actions, born of our actions, related to our actions, abide supported by our actions. Whatever action we do, for good or for ill, of that we will be the heir. So your thoughts. What rings for you when we go here?
Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I feel better because I know that we can do it. Mm. That we can do good. It's not just me trying.
Yeah. 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 I like when you say that we can do good. I admit that I'm the kind of suffering-oriented Buddhist that often can slide into hopelessness, you know, when I look at the world, and I could just be like, greed, hatred, and delusion feel pretty, pretty endless and uprootable, non-uprootable to me. So when you say that, a little light goes on in my heart that's like, oh, right, that thing where lots of people do good in a way all together, and something changes, you know. That does keep happening also. So I'm really happy you said that.
Sean, yeah. I sort of, I don't know, I disagree with you. Mm-hmm. You know, I was a public defender.
Oh, yeah, right on.
I defended a lot of murderers and rapists.
Yeah. What do you think?
And there's a part of me that challenges the whole notion of punishment completely.
Yeah.
That the only reason to lock Harvey Weinstein up is deterrence.
Right.
Either deter him personally or perhaps make an example of him so others will see,
totally.
I better not do that because I will be locked up.
Yeah.
But the notion that we're going to take some kind of vengeance on him for his sins.
Yeah.
We as a society are holier than him and not responsible for him in some way, some karmic way. By creating this whole capitalist system that demeans human beings as human capital, we can use them and throw them away, be they women or black people or whatever, whoever they are.
Nearly everybody.
Everybody is.
Yeah.
So there is a school back in the day when I took criminology.
Yeah.
That the whole notion of punishment, that prisons and crime should only be about deterrence. uh-huh. either specific, because yeah. the individual cannot control themselves and will continue, right. or a sex offender, let's say, like a Harvey Weinstein, will continue
right.
grabbing women off the street or whatever, or a child sex offender, compulsive.
Totally.
Or they have to give a message to others who may do it, that you're not going to get away with this.
Yeah.
So it's a general deterrence.
Yeah.
But this notion that that he sinned and we're going to punish him.
Yeah.
Doesn't
hold
up. Misguided.
Yeah.
You know, so that's another sort of, and I definitely agree with your notion that the collective karma of our society, and it's karmic from our, you know, what we right. did to African Americans or what
for sure.
culture, what or to women or to whoever or to Jews or to whoever it is somehow coming. It's all our responsibility.
Yeah.
And it's our inheritance from our
yeah.
ancestors as well.
All the way back.
And our future right. and we are the ancestors to the future generations. They're gonna reap the costs of what we do now.
Yes.
You know.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So then what's the part that you don't agree with?
That we should, that even any notion of punishment.
Right. Right.
As being and perhaps sort of a Christian type thing, the Jesus type thing of, you know, forgiveness in, if you take out the issue of deterrence, then nobody should be in prison.
Right.
Nobody should be punished.
Right.
You know, and if we had a village, the village did, maybe I'm romanticizing that the Native American Lakota Sioux small village of 500 or 1,000 people who all knew each other, who all had kinship relationships, all knew their place.
Yeah.
Nobody was locked in a stockade.
There's no prison there.
There was no
yeah.
prison there.
Yeah.
You know?
But there's, there's different cultures, you know, cultures like that have different, communal methods for, because, you know, people would still do wrong
yeah.
in every culture.
Yeah.
But there's different cultures have lots of different methods for, you know, rehabilitating or excluding, you know, exiling, bringing back in.
Counseling, you know, mentoring. You know,
for sure.
The whole restorative justice
yeah.
movement sort of is related to that.
So. Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, the piece that you bring about like, you know, locking up someone who just is going to repeat brings an interesting piece into this, which is, in a certain way, the Buddhist framework that hinges on individuals and communities practicing to recognize what is wholesome and what isn't. And it essentially has faith that beings want to be peaceful.
Yeah.
And so then there is a class of people who don't, that from this framework we would call insane, you know, in a certain way. Like someone who...
Sociopaths,
isn't it? Who has been so profoundly hurt in whatever way, whether that's genetic or systemic or whatever, who actually is far enough, so far away from wholeness that there's the pathway toward waking up enough to want to choose the wholesome is too difficult or hard to come by. Some kind of social response is needed to at least contain their, you know,
or
force.
Kill them, potentially.
Yeah, absolutely. And in the Mahayana texts, or in the one version of the Jataka tales that shows up a little later than the early texts, there is this one story that gets quoted a lot when we talk about this. And it's a story of the Buddha in a former incarnation as a sea pirate, or as a sea captain, and there's pirates nearby. And the sea captain, who was the Buddha in a former life, had as his crew a couple hundred bodhisattvas, so really holy beings, like a crew of sages, is sailing, and they get chased by a pirate, and the pirate is this sort of evil guy who wants to kill everybody on board and take the wealth, etc. And the pre-Buddha, the proto-Buddha, sees with his empathic, you know, powers that this pirate is not going to be able to make the wholesome choice to not kill these bodhisattvas. But killing holy beings like that is terrible karma. And it would throw that pirate into hell for a very long time to work out that karma. And the Buddha, out of compassion for the pirate, kills him. Mm-hmm. Being willing to take on the karma of killing one being out of compassion in order to save that being from the vast stretches of torment that his action would give rise to in him. So this is a dangerous story because it hints at a kind of, first of all, a kind of, corporal punishment kind of deterrence, but also preemptive. Like the sea captain hadn't done anything. The Buddha could just see, using his psychic power, that he was gonna. I don't know anyone around who could be like, with my psychic power, I can tell you're going to become a mass murderer, so out with you. And, not you really. But that's a dangerous model. But it proposes at least that the early writers were awake to the paradox or the challenge of this teaching. That it does open into, what do you do if such and such bad situation that arises all the time, in complex cultures. So I'm not ready to suggest that that's a model for any kind of modern punitive or restorative justice system. The only thing that I really feel comfortable leaning into as a model is that story about the king distributing resources in, recognizing that poverty is the source of crime. In so many cases. What else? Any other thoughts on this one? Yes.
Well, first of all, in relation to what you just said, I like the concept of no cruel and unusual punishment. Mm-hmm. And so, maybe if you're predicting that somebody's, that might be in our day and age, of course, be cruel and unusual.
Well, I went to high school in California. And so did you. Yikes. No, never mind. Go ahead.
But the other thing is, I feel as though we're all, on all sides of all issues, quite steeped in this marinating box of right and wrong and should, rather than what's going to have the best effect in terms of what to do about people doing bad things. Well, they should, every side of politics, they should have these kinds of consequences. This is what should happen, and this is what's right, and they're wrong. But, and I think, Peter, you were going more toward what's actually going to have the best effect in the long run.
And that's what you're making as a distinction could perhaps be understood in a way as a collision between the ancient Christian and the ancient Buddhist worldviews, as they're happening here. The idea of karma is very much about, Buddhism doesn't really use the words good and bad in terms of action. It uses skillful and unskillful.
Right.
And so that's all about what's going to have a certain result. There's no good or bad action per se, and the texts are actually really clear about this. They'll say, there's a text that says, just as the action of cutting someone open with a knife can be harmful if the intent is to kill, but skillful if the intent is to heal through surgery. Therefore, actions themselves are not the vector of karmic consequence. Intention is the vector of karmic consequence. So it's not about a certain thing being good or bad, as much as it is about, what will lead to a certain result. I think there's roots of this in the Christian system as well. If we think about good and bad meaning, what will lead one to heaven or to hell in the future is actually not that different from a doctrine of karma and rebirth.
If you think of heaven as happiness and hell as
well, suffering. Even as just future well-being or future suffering. You could spin it the same way, but the way our culture inherited the Christian worldview, it inherited the shoulds. I think this is really
important. And I think if you put somebody into jail, it may be a deterrent. They may have some breakthrough and, oh gosh, I realized that it was terrible what I did. But also they could be in prison and end up more hateful.
Yeah.
And so and very often what's going to be the result of what we do about it?
Right. Yeah. Right. And of course, there's whole movements of prison reform right now that, you know, that look very much at that. That, you know, there's really very little oriented toward rehabilitation in prisons right now, in many prisons right now.
Right, yeah.
Any other thoughts on this before we close? Yeah.
I'm not a scholar, and you would probably know this better. I know the source. But there is a Hindu source, I don't know if it's a Bhagavad Gita or Patanjali, but there's the way that you're supposed to react to anger or harm. There is one part where you're supposed to be indifferent. I love everything that you said, and I'm looking at it just with inside me, like when somebody does something off, like, should I be indifferent? Like, what's my aspiration? Do I want to be indifferent and not? Do I want to not think about Trump and get into that? Or how much do I want? I mean, I don't know where to go with any of the political stuff, honestly.
It's crazy making. But in both the Buddhist and Hindu traditions, there is this, you know, fairly extreme, to us perhaps, encouragement to cultivate a very radical equanimity in relation to harm as being done to us. You know,
equanimity,
which is maybe a nicer way of saying indifference, but you know, non-reactivity, vairagya would be the Sanskrit word from the Yoga Sutras. There's a Buddhist text. No one never teaches on it because it doesn't sound very good, but it's a text on maintaining the mind of loving kindness in all circumstances. And it says, even if bandits were to take you and sever your arms with a two-handed saw. Somehow it's particular that it's a two-handed saw. You know, you should still, you know, radiate loving kindness in all directions and not give rise to the mind of hatred. I'm like, okay, you know, I don't know that I would be capable of doing that, but it is, but it makes sense if you take the teaching all the way. You know, that the most important thing, the thing that you would not want to lose track of, even at the cost of your life, was your own mind state. If that's the thing that causes karma to unfold, then your mind state is the most important thing for you to it's the only thing you can affect in an immediate sense through your practice. And then your actions from that mind state ripple outward. But your mind state determines your actions. So your mind state is the most important thing. And so maintaining a mind of kindness, generosity, wisdom is in some ways like, that's like, hold on to that for dear life, even if they're killing you, as the text says. So that's tremendously difficult to practice and hard even to teach on, especially in a culture where self-denial and self-hatred could so easily arise in response to that teaching, like not being kind of not defending oneself in a certain way. So I don't want to fall into that trap, but I'll just say that in relation to what you're saying, that teaching of not just a kind of equanimity of heart, but even in the most dire of circumstances, maintaining equanimity of heart, it does in some ways follow from the teaching on karma and mind states. But, you know, if the bandits attack you with a two-handed saw, I would hope that you would, I don't know,
Run.
No, but it feels like Mandela did hold that a little bit.
Well, exactly. We see that in some of the great figures, for sure.
Well, there was some enlightened being that was in the Chinese concentration camps, and his biggest worry was that he would lose his compassion for his...
Right. Several of the Tibetans said this, yeah. Yeah, so that's some deep practice. Right there.
Yeah.
Right, so, you know... here's a prayer for the day to end us. No matter how long it lasts, through the age of Trump, may we not lose sight of our own basic goodness and the kindness in our hearts. everybody.